Hello, I'm Katie.
And I'm Leslie.
And we're all booked.
Welcome back to another episode of Sterling Municipal Library's podcast, where we talk to you about the books we'd like to recommend.
And Chasley is here with us today to talk about two books that are re-examining certain periods in history.
Hello!
So tell us about the two that you brought.
I brought Anne Boleyn, 500 Years of Lies by Haley Nolan, and 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus by Charles C. Mann.
So which one do you want to start with first?
I want to start with the Anne Boleyn book, because you always save, like, the best to last.
Oh, okay.
1491 is dessert.
I have a feeling you have some things to say about Columbus. But anyway.
I
500 Years of Lies definitely sets up quite a big, I guess, mystery to solve. I don't know what 500 Years of Lies is.
Right? Yeah. So her whole premise is that the story that's been told about Anne Boleyn, that she seduced Henry VIII and got her way into the monarchy so that she could be queen and have all the power. Her idea is breaking down all of that and being like, first of all, Anne started off life as a commoner. She would have never had any expectation of marrying a king who was already married in a time when divorce was not a thing. And so,
well, he fixed that real quick, too, though.
Well, that is true, and a couple times.
Creative thinker,
that guy. The writer, Haley Nolan, she has a social media miniseries called The History Review and also a podcast. So the history stuff is stuff she does a lot. This was her first book. It came out 6 months ago.
Oh, okay.
To some mixed reviews. Some of the customer reviews were actually my favorite. One of them called it sensationalist clickbait.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Them's fighting words.
One of them said, she's a writer who relies on exclamation points, who is not making a point. Nor is interspersing historical fact with contemporary slang impressive. It's more suited to Twitter than a history book.
Somebody's got their panties in a ruffle.
So they're unhappy that she had kind of like a casual tone when writing it?
Oh, no, wait, we're getting there.
Oh, okay.
I sincerely hope this isn't an example of scholarly efforts these days, one of them said. And my favorite, or perhaps I should say my least favorite, criticizes her feminist outrage.
Wow.
Feminist outrage. Apparently they've never had a conversation with me.
Don't they understand that women those days didn't have feelings about things?
Right. So feminism hadn't been invented then.
For reals, though, did you find her style too conversational?
Oh, no. Wait, we're still getting there.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
So the good reviews say that she has a modern energy, edgier appeal, accessible terms, and entertaining and engaging.
I was about to say, accessibility is a big thing, and that is what history texts.
Especially if
mean.
You want to sell nonfiction. I mean, don't get me wrong.
Yes.
There's a reason why narrative nonfiction is one of the more popular categories.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, right? Okay, so now we're going to read the back of the book. I have mentioned actually here before that I don't read the back of the book typically, or the inside blurb. It's perhaps because I have trust issues. I prefer to judge a book by its cover and its author and just jump right in at the beginning. And I have gotten some wonderful surprises that way. And, you know, you learn without expectation whether you're really going to enjoy the story that's being told, whereas the back of the book is sometimes just completely off base.
Mm-hmm.
However, this is what it says. History has lied. Anne Boleyn has been sold to us as a dark figure, a scheming seductress who bewitched Henry VIII into divorcing his queen and his church in an unprecedented display of passion. Quite the tragic love story, right? Wrong. In this electrifying expose, Haley Nolan explores for the first time the full, uncensored evidence of Anne Boleyn's life and relationship with Henry VIII, revealing the shocking suppression of a powerful woman.
I mean, it does really, really sell hard that everyone else was wrong. This
ripped
person
from
is
the headlines
right.
of history.
Yes.
Anyway,
from the headlines of history.
Unfortunately, the entire book is written that way.
Okay,
just like the blurb.
It's one of those things where you hate it, but you also kind of agree with the commenters that you don't like, where you're like, I understand your anger.
I honestly, except for the whole feminist outrage, I kind of agree with all of the reviews, bad and good. I think that her best point is that we have to stop portraying Henry and Anne's relationship as a love story. Love stories don't end with a beheading.
Yes.
And I think that's fair. She also does something that I think is probably right on, but is also extremely irresponsible, and she diagnoses Henry as a sociopath, which, you know, that they didn't have that term back then, and he never got a full psychological workup, so you can't just be like, oh, that dude's a sociopath, even though obviously, if he wasn't exactly a sociopath, he was probably
maybe
somewhere
in that
arena. He had affluenza. Woo, at the
I was about
very
to say,
least.
The monarchy did all sorts of things to people's heads. So.
Yeah. Oh, golly, yeah, including cutting them off. Mm-hmm. So this is my recommendation for the Anne Boleyn book. Mm-hmm. If you are interested in history or in Anne Boleyn in particular, but you have difficulty getting through a long, dry book full of footnotes and names that you don't know, this might be the book for you. Her writing is funny when she's not trying to be quippy. She does a great job of setting the scene so you really understand what's happening. The book doesn't depend on you already having any kind of background knowledge of the Tudors or the political climate of the 1500s. And Anne's story is a good story, which is why there are dozens of books and movies and TV shows about her and more being published just all of the time. This one came out 6 months ago. There's some on TV. Try Netflix. There's probably something about Anne Boleyn there because she is just such an appealing figure. I mean, to start with, we love that whole fairy tale, like, you know, rags to riches kind of story. And mm-hmm. that, if nothing else, is her. Except for just didn't end well. Happily ever after.
How did he meet her in the first place?
So it tells the story in the book, and I believe that they had, like, her father was involved in the political arena.
Okay.
He had a role, and so, like, she met him, and also Anne went away to serve under some royalty. And so, like, they were moving in similar circles, even though she grew up in France. It was still the nobility, and so there's lots of crossover there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And also, he had an affair with her sister.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's another way to meet people.
It is another way to meet people. That is definitely
That's how I hope to meet my husband.
Have you told your sister?
Do you think the writing style detracted from the academic, like, side of it? Like, do you think maybe you didn't learn as much or retain as much because of that?
I mean, I wouldn't say that I didn't retain as much, but mm-hmm. I did find myself just kind of, like, rolling my eyes and trying to skip past the points where she gets, like, really, like, this is all wrong, and I know what's right, and this is obvious. And some of the other, like, reviewers pointed out that, like, yes, this might have been really innovative 10 years ago, but apparently, like, a lot of the more recent Anne Boleyn scholarship has also picked up on these details, mm-hmm. especially as, like, feminist scholarship has become outrage feminism, has become feminist outrage, has become, you know, like, an actual legitimate form of criticism. And mm-hmm. so she...
So were there any instances in the book where you really felt like she was, you know, outraged as a feminist? Or
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Okay. But, like, it's not the term feminist outrage that really annoys me. It's that somebody would criticize you for having feminist outrage.
Yeah.
As though we're supposed to sit back and be like, ah, you know, it was a different time.
It was a different time. It was totally normal for a king of an entire country to take advantage of a commoner and force him to marry her.
And then behead her when she didn't have a son? Was that?
Yeah. Yep.
What was the ultimate reason
All
behind
I want
her beheading?
Is a scientist to go back in time to Henry VIII and be like, it's your fault you don't have sons.
Yes, very much.
And just come back to the future. That's all I want.
Okay, so, like, interestingly, like, Anne Boleyn's, like, actual reason for beheading wasn't just that Henry was upset that he didn't have sons. He mostly blamed God for that, really, more than Anne.
Oh, that explains, like, the whole split from the church at the time, too.
Exactly. Which, according to this and some of the research that she seems to have done, it was actually Anne's doing. She was the reformer who came in, and she was like, look, things have to change. And she kind of subtly taught him and pushed him until he did end up. Well, although, actually, the Pope broke with him at first because he didn't like some of the things Henry was saying about his leadership. But yeah, no, the inciting incident for Anne Boleyn's eventual beheading came from her stepdaughter, Henry's previous wife's daughter, Henry's daughter, Mary, who really was a devout Catholic and hated what Anne had done to her country. And so she started, like, drumming up all this dissent. And so she got these guys to be like, oh, no, Anne slept with all of these men, and including her own brother. And it just kind of snowballed.
Okay.
Sure, Henry was like, I can do that, but you can't do that. Shame on you.
Exactly. Like, literally.
Some of that feminist outrage for you out there.
Yeah. Like, when she was pregnant, she would be like, look, this woman is nice and isn't like an extreme Catholic. Please sleep with her. But at the same time, of course, Anne, who probably honestly didn't sleep with anybody because she knows how it's all going. Like, she's been around Henry. So.
Right. Wow.
Also, she was super busy. Like, apparently she spent all of these years, like, initiating programs to, like, help the poor and fund education. So, like, this whole, like, thing about her drive for power is kind of crazy when you look at the evidence of, like, her actual role. She did a tremendous amount of good and was blocked from doing more good by the House of Lords at the time, just, you know, keeping her from doing what she
was. Those
she
darn
wanted.
Progressives.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's move on from the feminist outrage to
feminist
1492.
Outrage.
1991, which I think is going to be even more outrage.
I do have a lot of outrage on so many issues. Okay, I have a lot of quotes from the book here to describe the book, and so I'm going to try to use my quoting voice.
Okay.
So, you know. So first of all, I kind of wanted to compare the criticism of what's been said. New York Times Book Review said that the book's approach is in the best scientific tradition, carefully sifting the evidence, never jumping to hasty conclusions, giving everyone a fair hearing, the experts and amateurs, the accounts of Indians and of their conquerors, and rarely is he less than enthralling. And that's basically everyone's opinion. At least everybody that matters loves this book and says that he did a tremendous job. As a comparison, he has 46 pages of bibliography at the end. This is a hefty book, by the way.
Yes.
And the Anne Boleyn book has 6. So just like a comparison of like the, you know, like the type of research that we're talking here. And oh my gosh, like his research encompasses like oral histories, archaeology, radiocarbon dating, surviving writings, haplotypes, like the genetic anthropology.
Yeah.
Okay, great. All this to show that these things that we learned in school about the American world before Columbus set foot is just completely wrong.
I love a good history book that's just like everything you knew is wrong and here's the science to back it up.
I know. Like, yes. Here's 45 disciplines that I have examined in order to prove what was actually true. To kind of set the year, 1491 was actually the year that Henry VIII was born. So we're going back in time a bit, but not a lot, really. It's 16 years before Anne Boleyn was born. So it's in that general time period while they're all going up in their, like, not romance and real stuff is happening. So his entire premise is that there are three things that we learned about the New World before Columbus. Quote unquote New World, right? We're also going to say quote unquote Indians because Native Americans is a term that he uses, but he said that when he was interviewing people of Native American heritage that invariably they did describe themselves as Indians, even though we know, of course, that's a misnomer.
Right.
And has been used offensively. It's still a term that they claim, and so he uses it along with the term Native American.
Mm-hmm.
All of that aside, the three things that we learned... The Americas were not densely populated before the white people. Native Americans did not vastly change their environment. That is, the white people didn't arrive to find London. And the North Americans were not technologically advanced. And he says these three things are like basic knowledge about the New World. He says they are all completely wrong. So, okay, you have this idea that when Columbus arrived and set foot on the islands and not the mainland of Americas, that there was this pristine wilderness. But a few miles away, you had the Aztec capital. They had running water, immaculately clean streets. They actually employed, they had like a government system of employees to help clean the streets and keep everything
running
nicely.
They had a public works department.
I mean, we've seen the evidence from the ruins.
Absolutely.
Those look gorgeous.
Yeah, but the really cool thing is that we're talking about like a part of the world that is densely forested. And so we're continuing to find those. Like in our lifetimes, they've found new ones and they are still finding new evidence that reveals that, like, our picture is horribly incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love a book like this that's like, let's take everything that we have been learning and let's think about how that really changes our understanding. The Aztec capital, I want to say it's Tenochtitlan. I didn't write that down and I don't know if I'm saying it properly, but you've heard the word, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Was larger than any contemporary European city. So in 1491, the Inca ruled the greatest empire on earth, bigger than Ming Dynasty China, bigger than Ivan the Great's Russia, bigger than the Ottoman Empire. It was extended over 32 degrees of latitude, as if one power held sway from St. Petersburg to Cairo.
Dude.
Huge. And so some researchers, not all, but some, and that is, like they said, you know, he does a great job of being like, these are the different viewpoints about it. This is from my research, which one I stand by, but I could be wrong, which is very nice.
A mark of a good, anybody with a scientific method behind them.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Some believe that the Indian population before Columbus, 1491, was between 90 and 112 million people, more in the Americas than in Europe. It's a huge number.
Mm-hmm.
So that whole idea of it being sparsely populated just doesn't hold up at all. So, of course, he doesn't just tell about 1491. He's really telling, like, the history of, like, the world at the time and how it's changed and how it was before. He says in 1492, the year that Columbus arrived, these people arrive and new germs arrive. When the microbes arrived, epidemics shot out to every corner of the hemisphere, to places that had never and would never see a white man with people living there.
We can relate to that a little bit now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Unfortunately. The first whites to explore many parts of the Americas, therefore, would have encountered places that were already depopulated. Some, not all, but some estimate that in the first 130 years of contact, 95% of the people in the Americas died.
Oh. Wow.
Yes. And honestly, even if that is way off, it's still an astronomical number based on what we can actually see.
Mm-hmm.
That's one reason that whites think of Indians as nomadic hunters. Everything else, all the heavily populated urbanized societies, were wiped out. So it's 128 years, and that's what he was saying, about 130 years of contact. 128 years from Columbus until the Mayflower.
Mm-hmm.
So they land on Plymouth Rock, and they're already seeing a world that has been drastically changed by white contact. I literally get chills, because like this is like, you know, everything that we've read and that we have been taught, that the pilgrims arrived, and look, here it is. And no, we already had so deeply affected it.
Yeah.
That whole pristine wilderness idea was a lie in so many ways. Until Columbus, the Indians were a keystone species in most of the hemisphere. If you don't know, keystone species is one that you cannot take out without, like, affecting drastically the rest of the ecosystem.
Right. And, I mean, for all intents and purposes, we were an invasive species.
Absolutely, yes. We were. Yeah. So they would annually burn undergrowth. They cleared and replanted forests. They built canals and raised fields. They had herded bison into certain areas. They netted fish. They had been managing their environment very deeply for thousands of years. And so then we show up. And we see these lush forests magically full of fruiting trees. And we don't think orchard because they're not planted in like rows and grids. Mm-hmm. And we see these groves of berry bushes and think, ah, this land of milk and honey that provided us by God. Instead of realizing how many hundreds or thousands of years this land had already been cultivated. And it's worse. So the Native Americans who had been doing this upkeep were mostly gone by now. Whole families and communities are gone. So what the scientists think happened next was Indian population collapsed. Clams and mussels exploded in number. Game like bison and elk overran the land. There was nobody to keep them in their designated areas and hunt them away from the crops. No people were harvesting tree nuts that had been planted and cultivated for centuries. So the passenger pigeons also experienced a population boom. Have you heard about the passenger pigeons?
Yes.
This is like, oh my gosh, this is one of my favorite things in the entire world. Actually, when I was watching the Outlander series on, I think it's on HBO or something. Anyway, I waited because in the books, what happens is that they see one of the things that in those first few hundred years, everyone would have seen, but which after that was never seen again. It was those flocks of millions of passenger pigeons that would darken the sky for hours because there were so many of them. Cool. His premise is that that's not natural. That wasn't what was supposed to happen.
Yeah.
White people arrived in large numbers, and 130 years later, what we see when we arrived isn't a healthy ecosystem. We wouldn't have understood that concept, of course, when Plymouth Rock, no, we wouldn't have known.
Yeah.
But that's what happens when this keystone species is removed from the ecosystem and it hasn't had time to balance out. And of course, we didn't help balance it out. We hunted the passenger pigeon and the Carolina parakeet to extinction and the bison nearly so. We didn't have any kind of knowledge of, you know, what was happening. Mm-hmm. But the world that we were already seeing had been so drastically altered, and then we came in and, well, we kind of ruined
wrecked shop.
Yeah.
Especially because we come into this land that's, like, full of all of these things, and we're like, wow, all for us, I guess.
It's
egotistical. Huge piles, like, I mean, they don't need this many passenger pigeons.
Right.
When, in fact, it was just a land that was, like, bouncing in the opposite extreme from, like, recovering from a meeting that you never knew happened.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So Charles Mann is, like, a great historian, and he doesn't do what I have done nonstop since I read this book, which is imagine that during 1491, people understood germs and the power of social distancing. He does say, having grown separately for millennia, the Americas in 1491 were a boundless sea of novel ideas, dreams, stories, philosophies, religions, moralities, discoveries, and all the other products of the mind. He says that, like, the great thinkers of Europe, Voltaire, Locke, Rousseau, and Hobbes, never had a chance to speak with these people or even know of their existence. And here at last, we begin to appreciate the enormity of the calamity. For the disintegration of Native America was not a loss just to these societies, but to the human enterprise as a whole. It's a bit of a bummer. I don't mean it to be, though. Like, it's this fascinating topic that we all think that we know plenty about. And, like, the re-education was brutal, but it's still just so good and such a wonderful read. I'd actually recommend this to anyone who isn't scared off from the prospect of a big, heavy book. Mm-hmm. It's not a difficult book to read at all. Like, for all that it has, like, a tremendously good scholarship, it's really readable. It's actually what I did the first week we were all home and couldn't work and go anywhere during the quarantine, is I sat here and I just read this, and it was wonderful. If you're a nonfiction reader especially, you'll appreciate what he's done here. And he has another book, 1493, He skipped over a year. Mm-hmm. It's called Uncovering the New World Columbus Created. Have you heard the term the Columbian Exchange? Like, I feel like I had, but then I was like...
I feel like I have too, but I don't have any definition tied to it.
It's, as the researchers call it, the Columbian Exchange is the reason there are tomatoes in Italy and oranges in Florida and chocolate in Switzerland and chili peppers in Thailand. Like, none of those things were in those places. They were in Central and South America. And so when people started, basically the beginning of globalization in a way, when people started that traffic, well... Yeah, real globalization. I guess it would just be Europealization.
Europealization?
Europe and Asialization. Europe, Asia, and Africalization. So, but then you have more and more of this traffic, and so you have more and more of this interchange. Earthworms and mosquitoes and cockroaches and honeybees and dandelions and African grasses and bacteria and fungi and viruses and rats of every description are we're exchanging around the planet. And so, like, the effects of that, I mean, you can't overstate how huge that is. Oh. And I'm so excited to read that book and see what he says about how that's affected our environments even to this day.
So, is there anything specific in this book that you read that really blew your mind? Because I feel like a lot of people probably have a vague idea of, like...
That what we've been told is wrong?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like, I haven't researched it, but it was written by the people who conquered it, so it's probably wrong.
Right.
But is there anything that really stood out to you as being, like... shocking almost, and like how wrong you were.
There were several things, but one of the big one was that we have more writings than I ever knew, you know, that exist from the world before 1491. He talked about like political leaders and even art, like some poetry and just some like regular record keeping that we actually still have. I think in my mind, the conquistadors came in and there was just nothing left. And in a way, that's definitely true compared, but we still have like large number of documents that he was able to like, you know, consult translations of to find out a little bit about the world at that time.
And it's just a shame that, because it's a failure of the education system that you can get to be a pretty well-educated, like, person in adulthood who just doesn't realize that this whole population of people has a history that is still around. The fact that it's not even mentioned or considered in school, they just go, oh, how sad, continuing on to this era. We just got to read a lot about a bunch of terrible people, and just a footnote in there is going to be like, and they all died.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. And I mean, like, honestly, even me, I have like a literature background.
Yeah.
And never once in all of that time did I come across any like ink and literature, and it's out there. And it's...
So if you were to recommend one over the other, which one would you choose?
I mean,
I
like
think
I said,
know.
It would really depend on my audience. I would definitely recommend 1491 just because I really feel like it's a tremendous work of scholarship. However, if I was talking to somebody, actually, you know what? I would love to know what a teenager thinks of the Anne Boleyn book because, you know, like...
It's like at that...
Yeah.
That level of, like... academic engagement where it's just like, I'm going to tell you stuff, but it's very casual.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I'm in my aged 30s, and so, like, it's a little obnoxious aged. To me, but I don't know, like, she's got to be at least in her 20s, and I kind of am curious if that would be too much, like, you know, like, teenagers hate it when you try too hard.
Try to be hip.
Yeah, yes. Try to be hip.
Yes.
Or if she would really be, you know, like, striking a chord, so I don't know.
I don't know, maybe next time I am able to have a book club, maybe we'll do...
do Anne Boleyn.
Maybe we'll do that. Because a lot of the YA novels do, they really simplify it, and it's less even about, like, vocabulary and more about...
Relatable stories?
Not even that, just, like, making it more casual, like, making it less, like... reading a sentence that has like 5 footnotes at the end to prove everything is right. All the resources are still there because usually it's someone who has read the original text and like translated it to teen.
Yes,
but because I just read Stamped, and the original is probably like 300 or 400 pages. The YA version is maybe 200, so it's a lot shorter, and it really just like hits the point of the issue. It doesn't it doesn't give you a bunch of like background information or anything like that. It's like, this is what it was about, maybe here's one example of it and why it's important, but you don't need 15 different footnotes, 8 different like sources. We just want you to be interested in this as a topic, and then you can figure out if you want to learn more about it. Like, read it first, and then you can see if you want more footnotes. So maybe it would be something like that, but I have a feeling that if it's as try hard as it sounds, that even teenagers would be like, she was kind of weird. Like,
yeah, that sounds about right on.
she kept saying like, Yeah, man. Groovy teens.
Yep.
Do you have, are you on like a nonfiction kick right now, or are these just two that you happen to pick up?
I am sort of on a nonfiction kick. Yeah. I actually just read a book about birds that was fantastic.
No one is surprised.
I cannot read too much about birds. But it was more about like animal intelligence, like in general, and how like we have this idea of like bird brain, but like some of like the, you know, the most intelligent species in the world are birds, and but how like they're so distantly, like, they're not closely related to mammals, the other smart ones, right? And so their brains are completely unrecognizable to ours, you know? And there's no crossover.
And their, like, intelligence is unrecognizable to us almost.
Because in a lot of ways.
It's evolved in such a different direction.
Yes.
I watched a documentary about bowerbirds once, which are great. Watch a documentary about bowerbirds, guys. And they all, like, choose this one specific thing for their nest. And one of them was next to a playground, and they chose shiny objects. So they just dragged a bunch of random playground stuff. But there was this one scene that will stick with me forever, and it was trying to drag a knife that someone had dropped on the ground, like across the, so it's this bird holding a knife in its beak, like hopping across the ground,
like the Goose Game,
and dragging it out. Yes, it's Untitled Goose Game. And it was just like, I mean, it was partially like, wow, it's so sad that humans leave such a terrible mark on their environment, but also hilarious, this bird is holding a knife.
Oh my god.
But yeah, they're very, very interesting, just like the things that they can recognize that I guess we don't think they can. It's the same thing, I think, we're just like, but it doesn't look like us, so it's wrong. And then you see them do something and you're like, oh, I guess maybe they are kind of smart, huh. Weird.
All right. Well, I think we're going off in tangent land.
Yes,
so I'm going to steer us back to the close. Is there any other thing that you wanted to say about either book?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for bringing us two nonfiction reads that kind of give us a different viewpoint of certain historical periods. And stay tuned next week for more fantastic book recommendations.
Bye.